All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And as promised in the back half of this first hour, we are continuing to focus on the resource sector as we are now chatting with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Matt, we have a few more big picture topics to get to here in terms of what investors should be looking for when investing in some of these companies. And in all fairness, what MJG is going to be doing with some of your capital. First and foremost, I do want to highlight something you sent out to your clients recently. It was a list of management red flags. Now, we always hear about how important management is, invest in management. Usually we hear the positives in terms of that, but I know we have a lot of listeners and we focus sometimes on what are some of the management red flags out there that you need to pay attention to. We're not going to be able to get to your whole list because I think it was quite a long list, but we can touch on individual ones. First and foremost, though, Matt, what were you trying to get across here in terms of these management red flags?
Good morning, gentlemen, and good to be back on the program here. First call of the new year between us. I hope it's off to a good start. You're right. I did get out the most recent MJG partnership investor letter a couple weeks back. For any listeners that are interested in reading the whole thing, available on the fund's website at mjgcapital.com. And one of the pieces in it that got the most feedback from readers was this list of management red flags. So basically what I did is I, through my own experience, as well as canvassing a few trusted investors in my network, accumulated a list of 25 different red flags, you know, focusing on some of the more obscure ones that could maybe be of use to readers of the letter. So, you know, I neglected to include, you know, management loading themselves up on, you know, cheap half-cent founder shares or management teams that have faced legal or regulatory issues before and focused on some more obscure ones. I would say they largely fell into four different categories. And these four categories were personal enrichment, distracted or loss of faith, warped incentives, and lifestyle companies as warnings as well. So those were kind of how they broke down. And I should also just include as a caveat, for any investor in this space, I think one of the best ways to avoid management teams that aren't going to do you well as an investor is to just focus on those teams that have treated you well as an investor or trusted members of your network well in previous deals. With that said, sometimes you do come across what looks like a very compelling opportunity with a group of people that you may not know all too well. And so I don't think it's worth discarding that out of hand because you aren't familiar with the principles. But that's, you know, in particular where this list of red flags can come in handy.
Yeah, Matt, it's so true that in general, a leopard does not change its spots. And so if they have a spotty history, you maybe want to steer clear. But in that sense, too, if a management team has been good to you and delivered repeatedly and built value in repeated companies, success also leaves clues. But let's dig into a couple of these. I'll start with the lifestyle companies because we hear that all the time. You want to avoid lifestyle companies. And if you drill down and ask people what they mean, a lot of people are talking about totally different kinds of companies or totally different things they're looking at. In general, it's people that are enriching themselves by paying themselves a fat salary and not really advancing a project. But how do you look at lifestyle companies and what are the red flags with lifestyle companies?
Yeah. Well, I think in the letter, there are seven or eight different points highlighted for this lifestyle company category. You know, two that come to mind at the moment, and this is a big one, looking at G&A spend and marketing. So G&A and marketing in one bucket relative to the company's market capitalization, as well as the amount of money put into the ground by companies. And really, you want to see companies putting at least 75% of their annual all-in budget into the ground. But unfortunately, in this space, that's often flipped on its head. And teams with overly inflated G&A, that means they're probably paying themselves too well and also traveling very well and not being judicious with company capital. And inflated marketing expenses can indicate that they're more focused on raising money so that they can continue to proceed with their chosen lifestyle as the CEO and management team, and less focused on actually creating value by putting money into the ground and hopefully driving a project forward. So that's a real big one that comes to mind that falls into that category. Another one would be management teams that have shown a tendency of what one member of my investing network calls ambulance chasing. And the idea of ambulance chasing is you'll see groups that every couple of years will abruptly pivot their focus to pursue whatever the hottest metal is at the moment, you know, the metal du jour. And you'll see the groups go from lithium to now uranium, which is most topical. And, you know, a year and a half from now, they may be focused on another metal. And if you see this, you know, clearly defined track record of ambulance chasing, it becomes clear that the group's less focused on actually creating value and bringing an exploration or development stage project to the point where it could be built and create real value for shareholders, more focused on just being in the hot space so that there's always access to capital and money available. So on the lifestyle front, those are two that come immediately to mind.
Now let's talk about the personal enrichment warnings then too, because this can sometimes be tied into lifestyle type companies if, I guess, management is paying themselves too much, but it's a whole bigger picture here. So what on the personal enrichment aspect would have you concerned?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, there is some bleeding over between the two categories, I will admit. But a few on the personal enrichment front. One of my favorites is to look for whether key members of management personally own a royalty over the company's flagship project. Royalties can be extremely valuable in this business, especially as we've learned over the past 20 years, especially in North America, as the royalty business model has taken over. And for a properly incentivized team, they don't want royalties on their assets. They don't want their assets to be encumbered. The more encumbered an asset, the less likely it is to ultimately be pushed forward and become a mine. So if you see a member of management who kind of sneakily has a 1.5 or 2% NSR over the company's flagship project, that to me is a bright red flag, unless there's some, you know, absolute extenuating circumstance that could potentially justify that. I guess another quick one would be, you know, board and management teams that issue themselves options that vest immediately. There's no reason that should occur within this industry. They should be gated and invest over multiple years to ensure that the team's committed to the cause over the time frames that are necessary to actually create value in this industry. And I guess another one that we'll see somewhat often are key members of management being granted outsized discretionary bonuses for events that are well within the company's normal course of business. So you're already, in a lot of these cases, being paid pretty well to be a top dog at one of these companies. And if you do your job well, you should already be well incentivized between the shares you hold and the salary that you're receiving. And so there's no reason for there to be, you know, reward heaped on the top, again, unless it's an incredibly exceptional circumstance.
Yeah, Matt, there is no shortage of companies heaping those rewards onto their management teams to keep rewarding themselves for really underperforming and not putting much money in the ground. There's another one I want to ask you about. We were talking a little bit about it off mic. I don't know which category you'd put it in, but it's the nature of when a company has multiple projects and they decide, you know what, we're going to spin one of these out, and you notice a management team shuffle, and then a lot of the focus on the flagship project that they've been touting for years as this is our favorite child suddenly becomes orphaned because they get interested in the new SpinCo, and then it's a whole new life for them and a whole new lifestyle company. What do you do with SpinCos? Because there's good ones and there's bad ones.
That's right. Now, I mean, this one is more nuanced, but I definitely do touch on SpinCos. So I think as an investor, you need to look at it a couple ways. First, is the SpinCo warranted? And sometimes it is. Sometimes it's a very valuable project. It's time for it to shine. And it's not receiving value within the mother co. So said SpinCo occurs, then the question is, should the management team of, you know, the mothership also assume a role at the SpinCo? Sometimes that can be justified. Sometimes that cannot be justified. But the biggest red flag to me is when there's a SpinCo out of the mothership. Management of the mothership do not take management roles at the SpinCo, and yet management from the mothership receives founder shares, options, you know, cheap shares in the SpinCo, even though they're not going to be participating in its management going forward. So that regretfully happens more often than not than you would expect within this industry. So that to me is the brightest red flag. Sometimes it can be justified for management to take over control of the SpinCo as well. So it can get a little bit more nuanced in those perspectives. But yeah, we do see circumstances where even though there's no involvement from the point of the SpinCo going forward, management still pockets a bunch of cheap shares, you know, for their own benefit. So I do throw that into the personal enrichment category.
All right. Well, if you want to find out all of the more obscure red flags that Matt outlined, again, you can go over to the MJG Capital website and get some more information from his letter that he sent out. Let's talk about this year's strategy for the MJG fund then, especially when it comes to new investments. When we talked to you last year was a lot slower of a year for you in terms of adding positions, in terms of adding new investments, but it did start to pick up at the tail end of the year. What's 2024 look like?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Corey. We actually went a full 8 months without initiating a position between February of 2023 through early October 2023. So that is actually the longest period without adding a new name within the portfolio that we've undergone since the fund's inception. So a lot of patience, a lot of sitting on my hands and waiting over that period. However, as we headed, you know, into mid to late Q4, it really just got bleak out there. While I was waiting for the broader market to roll over, that simply did not occur. But nonetheless, juniors were getting slammed, really, really blown out. And this is in a period where metal prices hung in there pretty well. The prices of senior mining equities hung in there pretty well. Of course, the broader market was rip-roaring ahead. So we saw this huge disconnect between the junior space and really most other financial markets. So I did make the decision at that point to plug my nose and buy when things were cheap and unloved, even though it felt unpleasant and uncomfortable because we hadn't seen that broader market crash that I was waiting for that is yet to transpire. So basically over the past 90 odd days, we've participated in four different private placements, kind of in force, and went from what was a double-digit cash position to now close to fully deployed. So very aggressive deployment in a pretty short period of time. You know, to your question, that means we're going to be pretty inactive here for the next few months as we kind of rationalize these recent deployments. You know, the MJG fund is open-ended, and I'm expecting further inflows in the coming months. So we will have some dry powder to deploy this spring, but certainly not anticipating doing any further deals or adding any new positions on the open market between now and at least the PDAC conference in early March. So we're back to a bit of a period of sitting and waiting. I definitely don't anticipate it's going to be another 8 month wait though before we add our next name. I will note it's actually looking to be a good time to deploy into placements. Just in the past week or two, we've seen a number of companies come out with pretty positive terms from an investor perspective, not from a company perspective. We're seeing a lot of full warrants, long dated, no accelerators, you know, being tacked onto financing. So especially if this continues, I could see us doing another deal or two, but most likely in the spring to late spring period.
So Matt, one more quick question regarding the position of the MJG fund and how you said you're almost fully deployed. I'm sure a lot of investors in the space also feel that way, that they're fully deployed. But that brings up the question of how do you go about balancing out current positions with opportunities in other companies? We all know there's so many companies out there. And quite frankly, when we are trading amongst ourselves here, you do have to play that game of, even though I'm in this position, is there another position? Is there another company that I like maybe more? Has the story changed? How do you go about balancing that?
Yeah, no, very fair question. Look, and it's going to be different. The answer is going to be different for each investor. We all have different temperaments and different capital deployment styles. I guess I'd say for the MJG partnership, one of the easiest ways to decide to liquidate a position is if you're expecting a catalyst and it either comes back negative or the company, you know, does not deliver and it's been delayed. So if we see changes to the timeline, or, you know, this is a highly risky business, sometimes, you know, management gets a shot on target and it just doesn't pan out. You know, that's probably the easiest and most obvious reason to sell a position, which can then free up cash for another opportunity. I generally won't liquidate a position entirely if I believe that it's undervalued, management is doing what they said they would do, and there's upcoming catalysts that could really create a change in value. However, you know, there are opportunities to maybe trim positions in terms of just waiting within the portfolio if there's an insanely compelling opportunity that I just can't miss. Within the MJG fund, I try not to allow any of our positions fall below a 2% weighting within the overall portfolio. My view is that if I don't have enough conviction for each of our positions to at least be 2% of the portfolio, then it's not the right time to invest in them, or it's maybe just not the right opportunity at all. And then there are a couple, you know, larger positions. And if we see a run in share price, you can use an opportunity to trim some of your outsized positions. But I think that really depends on how you classify an investment. So, you know, some of the investments I view as compounders, names that I expect to, you know, own for the rest of this decade or as long as the MJG fund is around. If they go on a good share price run, I'm less inclined to sell. Other names I view more as cigar butts, as in Ben Graham's parlance. Names that are trading at a, you know, stark discount to what I think their fair value is. But if they were to increase 50% in price in a short period, it'd be a lot easier to trim, if not sell the position entirely, because fair value is unlikely to move all too much unless there's some really unforeseen development. So again, it gets pretty nuanced, but it really will depend on those factors. And I guess another one I'll throw in there. I mean, we do try to balance jurisdictional risk within the portfolio. So if we have a lot of exposure to a given jurisdiction between a couple investments, and there's a new investment that is just too good to pass up that is also focused on said jurisdiction, you know, I would look to the two other names that are exposed to that jurisdiction as places to potentially trim. So that's another way to think about it. So pretty nuanced, but it's an important question.
Well, Matt, I know that in general, you like to look at company-specific opportunities. You like to evaluate the management teams, the project, and go through all the things before you even look at what commodity it's in. But if I could tie you down and hold a gun to your head here and say, hey, Matt, which particular commodity do you see maybe having the most attractive setup in the year to come? Your ear is to the ground in the sector, and you get your finger on the pulse. You talk to a lot of people. Which area do you really think may surprise people in 2024?
Okay, well, there is a metal I want to talk about, but I mean, directly to your question, you know, we're very well exposed to copper. It's our largest metal by weighting, so I'm quite comfortable with copper at the moment. I think we could see upside, partially only due to the supply picture. I mean, we've obviously seen a big disruption in global supply through the Cobre Panama fiasco. I know you've had plenty of guests discuss that, but that's going to have repercussions years to come within the copper complex. And then we've also seen a lot of the major miners come out and both disappoint on production in 2023 on the copper front, as well guiding lower in terms of expectations over the next couple years. So, you know, that's one that could surprise over the course of 2024. I mean, I would say the metal that's most contrarian at the moment, and I don't think it's going to be a lucrative investment over the next 12 months per se. These cycles can take time to play out. They do take time to play out. But nickel, boy oh boy, has nickel become a contrarian opportunity. And I think it's an interesting hunting ground for new deals. You know, nickel was the worst performing base metal in 2023 by quite a margin, down over 40% over the course of the year, and down over 70% since the high profile nickel squeeze occurred in early 2022. This weakness has primarily been due to a flood of supply from Indonesia, which increased supply year over year in 2023 by a stunning 30%. So we're just seeing masses of nickel come online from new projects in Indonesia. And then on the demand front, we've also seen really quick uptake of lithium iron phosphate battery chemistries for electric vehicles and other battery applications, really as competition for the nickel manganese cobalt chemistries, which just a few years ago were the dominant chemistry. They still are, but the pendulum continues to swing towards lithium iron phosphate. So kind of headwinds on the supply and the demand front. And I just can't understate how ugly it's been out there. Just in the past 60 days, and I'll try to hammer through these quickly, we've had close to a dozen different developments across the nickel sphere. I mean, we had the bankruptcy of Panoramic Resources and their Savannah mine in Western Australia. That was in December. Just in the past couple of weeks, we've had First Quantum idling their Ravensthorpe operation in Western Australia. Past 2 weeks, we've had Wyloo Metals announcing that their Kambalda asset was going to be put on care and maintenance. And they literally bought this asset 6 months ago from Mincor Resources. So boy, is that a quick about turn for Wyloo Metals. BHP has had talked in the past 10 days or so about running their Nickel West operations at partial capacity and also considering a write down of their nickel unit as a whole. We have IGO just yesterday, so I guess that was Wednesday, January 31st, announcing that they were putting their Cosmos project on pause. And that was a project they just bought from Western Australia earlier this year. So that's another quick about turn in the nickel sphere. And then you have groups like Trafigura and Glencore saying that they're going to stop funding entirely their nickel laterite operations in New Caledonia and try to find additional capital. Otherwise, those operations won't continue forward. So it really looks extremely bleak. And this does pique my interest as a contrarian investor to look at nickel-focused opportunities. That said, there's really no rush. These things take time to play out. It could still be a lot more ugliness to come, but I do think the bottom is closer than not. This is the type of activity and the type of behavior you see when a metal price is bottoming. And yeah, again, there's no guarantees we'll make a move on an investment or two, but if you're looking at a metal that's as contrarian as it gets, I would throw nickel into that category at the moment. And you know, with everything on sale, you may as well look at the very best high margin operations, probably on the sulfide front of things. So whether it's a name in production or more likely for the MJG funds, very, very high quality nickel sulfide development assets, with everything on sale, no reason to compromise for anything but the best.
All right, Matt, thank you very much for your time. I always find it so fascinating to hear what you're doing within the MJG partnership and your fund and what deals you are looking at, including the type of metals you're looking at. So, hey, we all very much value your time. I will post a link to the MJG Capital website within the weekend show posting, and I'm sure we'll chat with you next month. Matt, thanks for joining us on this weekend show. Everyone, thanks for tuning in to the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.